If you've recovered from COVID-19 or unknowingly been exposed to it, you may have antibodies that could help COVID-19 patients. Donate blood and receive testing for COVID-19 antibodies. Visit Vitalant.org today.
A different future starts with you. That's why GoDaddy does more than help you find a name. You can create, sell, and get found online, so any small business could be a driving force to create change or build an empire. We know old ideas aren't cutting it anymore, so we're calling for a new generation of thinking, your way of thinking. So whatever you have in mind that will help make a different future, find everything you need to get started at GoDaddy.com. Because the future isn't decided yet. It's up to us to make it happen. Start different at GoDaddy.com.
This is an ode to the glass noodle. You may be glass only in name, but our love for you is crystal clear in every Bibigo Korean dumpling. Your tantalizing texture tickles the taste buds, and while you are see-through, the world can't help but see you. The glass noodle, one of many obsessively crafted ingredients in every plump and juicy Korean dumpling from Bibigo. Go handcrafted. Go Bibigo. Authentic Korean dumplings now in the freezer aisle.
This is Podco Media Networks.
It's the Innovation Podcast with Mark Reed Edwards and Garnett Harriman. Let's start the show.
Hi, it's Mark. We're back with Moira Kelly, Innovation Fellow at Boston University and President and CEO of Exploration Learning. Michael Hoffman, founder and CEO at Gather Voices, will be with us soon, as will Jarrett C. Riddick, director of the U.S. Army's Vehicle Technology Directorate. Plus, we have some special things planned for the new year, including a takeover of the iPod by Lane Jost of PwC. Lane will be focusing on investing for impact. But now, let's get back to our discussion with Moira.
So I have a Lord of the Flies question for you. because, you know...
Aren't they all? Aren't they all from you?
Pretty much. because I have a very odd, specific expertise. And on the other hand, I'm a real generalist, right? I've only ever built and sold companies and invested in companies, or typically early stage tech companies.
Okay.
Literally have not held a job other than that since my, I think, mid-20s. And I'm 52 this year.
Okay.
So that's a pretty long career, just pretty much doing, living in that space that is so astonishingly uncertain and fraught with risk and, anxiety. So how do you prepare both teachers and students in your classroom settings for this notion about what the, and I'm going to use a word that may be inappropriate, but I can't think of another word for it at the moment, but like the moral and ethical guardrails. So if I were doing the archipelago exercise and I decided that, my solution was going to be to have a raid on the next island and kill all of the male children of a certain age and enslave the women, what kind of response would I get from the teacher?
Well, that's a really good question, because one of the things that...
Well, it's scary that I even think about shit like this, to be honest.
No, but I think it's,
it's even scarier that I can make a semi-erudite reference to a novel to justify it, right?
Well, yes, absolutely.
That's scary stuff, dude. That is education gone awry, in my opinion.
Well, a couple of things. We talk about values.
There you go. That's what I'm waiting for.
It's interesting. I was having a conversation the other day with a school leader about how do you develop people of character?
But it
sounds so like 1950s, right? part of the question for me is sort of like, it's not really an old-fashioned notion, but what does a person of character mean?
I love
it. In the 21st century? And I don't have a prescription for it. I think part of this is...
Well, I'd be ecstatic just to learn how to talk about it without pissing off, because you can't have that dialogue in like regular, one-to-one or like dinner party conversation without pissing somebody off.
Except that here's one of the things that when I'm working with, everybody, you start talking values and people go like, oh my gosh, you can't talk about that. It's like, oh, everybody's got different ones, right? But in some ways, I would say not totally true. I mean, for the most part, I think if you say, are there some universal values? Are there some things that pretty much wherever you come from, everybody kind of agrees they're good, like being kind to people, that we shouldn't steal or what, I think there are some ways to discuss these things. But I think the other thing is that it's not for me to tell you what your character should be per se, but it is my job as an educator to engage you in discussions to help you figure out, for instance, what is your ethical framework? What is an ethical framework? And what are the components of it? And so that's when you get to these guardrails, right? I mean, I think part of the thing is that we've had problems with is we haven't had the conversations. And I think we run away from the conversations because we feel like somebody is going to try and tell our kids to be something that we don't want them to be. And I think it's less about that and more that we all are going to have to grapple with principles. What are the principles that animate our lives or are important to us? And I think helping equip teachers to have those conversations, but then also, you know, going back to this island planning course, right? When kids want to do a raid on it's one thing to joke about doing the raid. And, you know, when you get a bunch of kids in a class, of course, they're going to joke about doing it. Right? I mean, it's play, right? But at the same time, if you actually
I think you're calling me childish, but okay.
I'd let you goof around, right? I'd let you joke about it. But if you actually go over and try and do it, that's a whole other story. So,
well, I didn't even get to the cannibalism part.
Oh, another thing, right? Yeah. Well, but even that one, right? The question for that one would be for me is, to raise with students, are there any conditions under which you think cannibalism might actually be okay?
When you're really, really, really hungry.
Right? When you're stuck on a mountain and there's nothing else around and you're going to die. You know, what are those things? But I think dialogue, going back and forth and this kind of stuff is, and kids love to have conversations about this. And it's important that they can have these conversations. And I don't think that we open up enough space in school for them to be able to do this enough.
So I am so happy that you didn't shy away from this question because, you know, it's not something honestly, even in like private one-to-one conversations with trusted friends, colleagues, people shy away from it. And it's just, I think what you said makes a lot of sense, actually. You know, just talk about the structure and the framework and or the guardrails without telling people what to think. Interesting.
People can come to their own conclusions, you know.
Sure.
But I do think, you know, people can come to their own conclusions. But what I want to see is people actually are in dialogue with one another, hashing it out back and forth and not running away from having the discussion. And I think that's too much of what we're doing now.
Yeah. Yep. And it's got to be because it's so painful in some ways, right? I mean, I feel like in my personal life, trying to have these discussions have ended up in like, you know, painful or, you know, challenging, you know, friction-filled type places, unfortunately.
Oh, sure. Well, we don't know how to do it well. I mean, it's just not something that, I mean, you know, there's some families that have conversations like this all the time and there are other places that don't. And if you don't
not
learn,
mine.
Right? Well, mine either. Mine wasn't one of those either. And so if you don't learn at home, you don't learn it at school, you're kind of stuck in a lot of ways, you know?
And it's funny. And now this will be my last comment. I don't want to beat this to a pulp or anything, but you know, that notion of the moral ethical guardrails, you know, what's funny about it is that you can, as an individual, you can know and have a clear sense of what your own, I use the phrase moral compass. You can have a clear sense of what your own moral compass is and still have a lot of difficulties either explaining it to other people or engaging them in a way that makes them comfortable talking about their moral compass. It's a challenging topic for sure.
Yeah, it definitely is. But I think, you know, one of the things I think is really interesting about the whole moral compass piece is, you know, having been to law school, one of the things that happens in law school is, you know, you've got a professor who stands up there and you answer his or her question and then they change the case slightly, right? And they keep on changing it. And then you find after they've changed it two or three times that what you thought was really true, you're not now so sure that it's true, right? And I think that you can have a moral compass, but when it actually is applied to things out in the world, it's the application piece for a lot of us that becomes challenging because we think of this stuff in abstractions.
Yep. No, that's true. So moving on to our next topic, if you could think of things, let's say three things that schools should focus on that they're not currently focused on, what would those things be?
One of them might be So maybe three things, you know, and maybe if you ask me this next week, it'll be slightly different, but I'd say...
Wait a minute, just like the law school professor.
Right. Well, the world changes, you know, so you can't get stuck in one thing. I'd say cultivating creative confidence would be one. This whole notion of helping students develop character, whatever that means for them, and cultivating curiosity. And the reason I'm saying these three things is that I think that creative confidence is thinking about generating possibilities. And it's both kind of coming up with your own, but also getting inspiration from other places. And then dealing with new possibilities also means that you're inherently dealing with risk and uncertainty because you just don't really know where things are going to end up. And it's becoming more comfortable with that uncertainty. And that it's also about learning that you don't need to see constraints as something that's bad, but actually as something that gives you some guidance or can help refine your thinking. And it's also the thing where you become more comfortable with things not working out the first time or the third time or the fifth time or the tenth time. It really is in a lot of ways the antithesis of what we're measuring on standardized tests. And you can tell when somebody has creative confidence. And actually, I would say most people had it at one point with little kids. If you spend any time with little kids, you know, 4-year-olds, 5-year-olds, they have loads of creative confidence that we kind of knock out of them over time. You know, and then I'd say this character piece we talked about a lot, it you know, it sounds old fashioned, but I also think that it's really about helping. It's at the heart of what it means to be fully human. And it is examining our humanity. And I think this is really essential as we go more deeply into this fourth industrial revolution where we've got these disruptive technologies and trends like virtual reality and robotics and the Internet of Things and artificial intelligence that are just fundamentally changing the way that we live and work. And that this revolution is actually challenging ideas of what it means to be human. I mean, I kind of think of sort of like Star Trek and the Borg. And I mean, that might have at one point seemed like totally crazy, but, you know, it's starting to go like, oh, maybe that's really not that far out there. And I think that there are tremendous opportunities that this revolution is going to bring, but if we don't harness the power of this technology and everything else that's coming at us so that we put people first, it's just going to be really important that we understand how to make ethical and principled decisions. So that goes back to this character piece. And then I think the third one is curiosity. And I think to me, it is the driver of solving the world's most complex problems. It is the fuel that makes someone a lifelong learner. And I think that in this age of acceleration, the only way people are going to thrive is becoming lifelong learners. And curiosity is absolutely tied to that. And so I think that in curiosity too, interestingly enough to me, is also tied to engagement. And Gallup did a study a few years ago where, oh my gosh, it was incredible. If you look at this chart about engagement in school, kids are in not bad shape until about fifth grade. And then it absolutely starts to fall off a cliff. And so by the time kids are in high school, they are just not engaged at all. They are going through the motions of being in school. So
does that coincide with when the standardized tests start in earnest and the teaching actually changes?
Well, interesting you say that. There is more testing, but it actually, we in the United States love standardized testing even in elementary school. But I think one of the things that happens is up until grade 8, most teachers that I talk to and school leaders feel like they've got some latitude to study topics that, quote, are not on the test. There's a little bit less content that they feel they must get through. But when you start high school, because the drive for so many places is get these kids into college, and you have to have X number of courses in math and X number in this and that, it's kind of like we need to put aside all that other stuff and we need to focus in on what's happening. And, you know, I mean, if you're taking U.S. history, for instance, in high school, I can't tell you the number of teachers who say, I know kids want to linger on this. They want to talk some more about X, Y, or Z. But at this pace, I won't get through the Vietnam War, right? It becomes running through content. And that happens more at the high school level. And so kids go through the motions, they disengage, they do the test, but they don't, there's very little deep learning that's going on in most places. And it's really unfortunate. So anyway, those would be my three that I would focus more attention on in schools in a more systemic way.
What's really great about those three is that they're really easy to remember because they all begin with C.
So, the three C's.
I'm sure that's gonna get you a lot of traction out there in the real world. So it's all good. So I think I already know the answer to this question just based on...
It's easy to remember. easier to make things, the more likely folks will actually act on.
COVID-19 patients need your help.
If you've fully recovered from COVID-19...
or unknowingly been exposed to it,
you may have the antibodies that could help COVID-19 patients recover.
Donate blood and receive testing for COVID-19 antibodies.
Visit Vitalant.org today to schedule an appointment to donate blood.
That's Vitalant.org. Help save lives and schedule your appointment at Vitalant.org.
You could help save lives.
I think I know the answer to the next question that I'd like to bring up, because you've started to touch on it in several points in this conversation already. But it feels like when you use words like, you know, there's a revolution coming in, you know, education and preparing kids for the future and jobs and all that, it feels like you see some positive momentum for change. Can you talk a little bit more about where you see that and what you think is driving it?
Yes, I see momentum for change. It's not as much momentum as I would like there to be, but I think we all know this isn't working, right? I mean, I don't, for the most part, I'm not seeing kids going like, oh, school works really well. Teachers are not saying it. Parents are saying this. We've got loads more kids dealing with anxiety and depression, and we know it doesn't work. And we're starting to back off some of the standardized testing here in the United States, but also some governments are backing off in other countries too. So for instance, Singapore has been a country with really high educational achievement for a long time. And they've dropped exams for younger kids and are moving away from this notion as education is competition. And when I was in London at the Education World Forum, I was speaking with quite a few ministers of education and their staff about how education has changed. And I'm not saying that from the perspective that I was pushing this. They were talking about, they're very well aware that we have become too focused on content and not on skills like critical thinking and collaborating with others and working on emotional intelligence. And that people may see these things as soft skills, but they actually are the skills that we need for the future. And these folks are noticing this and seeing this in other countries because they're seeing that if we don't develop those, these skills that we are currently, that we have been working on at schools, are ones that AI is going to pick up pretty quickly. And if I can have a computer do this, it's going to be cheaper and easier and faster. I don't need a human being doing this. And so they know that things need to be changing. And so I think that there are individual schools. I mean, there's one school I'm thinking of that is in Idaho. Actually, it's outside of Boise. It's called One Stone School. And, you know, fascinating place. It's the kids essentially run the show. It's an independent, nonprofit, tuition-free school. And the board of directors at the school, the chair of that board is a student. And the majority of board members are students. And the students spend a lot of time outdoors, outside the school, actually working on projects with businesses and doing self-design learning projects. And one of the things that you'll see in that school is a level of self-confidence and maturity in those students that you don't see in the halls of a traditional school. There are other schools like Big Picture Learning. Someone who started their teaching career with us at Exploration actually is one of the leaders now of Big Picture Learning. They've got 55 Big Picture schools where students are learning in the real world, and students are paired with a mentor and they do internships. They're basically apprentices and doing some amazing work. And then there are other schools moving in a direction of competency and mastery. So what that is instead of like you have to sit through 180 days of school for 44 minutes in this particular class, if you're working on, which, you know, as we all know, some kids are going to be moving very quickly. Other kids are going to be dragging behind. A teacher's trying to kind of average everything. Doesn't serve everyone in the class well at all. If you're doing a master competency-based system, it's much more personalized. So if you want to zoom ahead and you can zoom ahead, you can. And if it takes you longer to master something, that's okay too, because you work at your own pace. It really is, it's about actually learning something. And the aim is for you to master the skill, not to adhere to somebody else's schedule. So these are all things that are happening, and there's loads more happening too. So I think that there's momentum going, and there are lots of experiments happening all over the place. And so I think we should be heartened. It's just, you know, are we going to move quickly enough is the big question.
So I love that you mentioned the Singapore example, because that to me is the sort of a disjuncture there. And so for the last 30, 40 years, Singaporean society has been fairly, I don't know, autocratic, rule of law oriented, very like law and order oriented, that kind of stuff. You know, the trite example is people getting caned for spitting on the sidewalk or for, you know, dropping their gum on the sidewalk and that kind of stuff. I mean, and by the way, foreigners are included in those punishments or have been historically. So if they're moving away from this kind of like highly regulated, very stringent, very, very formulaic approach with younger kids, I think is the qualification you made, and instituting no tests. That's, to me, that's kind of a breakthrough unto itself. I mean,
yeah, we've got an advisor for us. His name is Yang Zhao, and he's fabulous. And he speaks all over the world, does a lot of great research. And, you know, one of his questions for me was like, Moira, you know, I've seen this all over the place. You know, you Americans, you know, here in America, and his kids are in the United States, have gone to university and to high school. But what he's finding is that he's still doing a lot of work in China, and that China is now moving more quickly on inquiry-based learning and moving in a, you know, I don't want to say it's happening across the board, but moving in a direction of what we used to be more like. The United States ran down this path of accountability and high stakes testing, kind of at the same time that other places in the world were starting to move away from that from their own system. So we started moving toward a system that's more like the old Chinese system as they were moving away from it. And I think all of us now are kind of going like, better ways to do this than what we've been doing.
So let's talk about the future, both, you know, within the XPLO ecosystem, and then just based on Moira Kelly's worldview and, you know, macro analysis, the latter being, you know, my favorite part of the whole podcast, really. What does the future hold for XPLO as an organization and as a think tank, as it were?
Well, so one of the things we're doing is we are remaking our high school program to emphasize getting students out into the world, doing real world projects and working with experts. And part of the reason behind that, I'll give you an example of something. We were starting a program in emergency medicine, and I really wanted kids to be able to put their hands on things that they wouldn't normally be able to do at school. And
like a corpse.
And so
all of a sudden now we have body snatchers working for XPLO. No, I'm kidding.
Well, I don't know how I was able to do this, but I was able to arrange to get into the Brigham and Women's Hospital Simulation Lab that they train their doctors on, new doctors and medical students. And they said, yeah, we would work with you. But before we sent any students over there, I wanted to see if it was really appropriate to send our kids over there. So I spent the afternoon there with Dr. Kathleen Whittles, who was fabulous. And my family is not in medicine, but I put in airwaves and I learned to put in IVs and I defibrillated these robots. And I had the time of my life. And I remember turning to Dr. Whittles and saying to her at the end of this, I got to tell you, if I had known that this is, you know, what medicine is like, I think I would have done this instead of going to law school. and I still believe that now, right? And I'm not sorry I went to law school. I picked up some good skills. But I think that depending on the family that you come from, you don't have exposure to loads of things. I happened to, in high school, to have lived in a very rural area, and it was a farming community. So we had very few professionals around. And so I didn't even know what most jobs were. And I think that we need to get kids out and exposed to professions and jobs and possibilities in a more direct way than instead of just talking about these things. Because I think that's when you start to notice things about yourself that you get really drawn to something. And it's not to say that pursuing that is going to be easy. You may have many years of school, you know, medical school or something else that you need to do or other work. But finding out what lights you up, I think, is really pretty important. So we're doing that at the high school level. And then we're also actually gearing up to launch an innovation network and consultancy for schools in a more formal way. So at the end of next month, we're hosting a gathering of school leaders. And they're coming in from across the US and Brazil and China, actually the UK and Doha. And what we're going to be looking at is people talk a lot about innovation in schools, but the challenge is really moving thought into action. And that's what this network is about. And what we're also looking at is we are also bringing people in from folks who used to work with the Harvard Negotiation Project. We are bringing in an idea hunter who's a dean at a major business school. We're bringing in people from higher ed, from NGOs, because when we think, when we at Exploration think about idea hunting, it comes from all different realms. And part of what we're looking to do then is go idea hunting out in the world and then translate those ideas into actionable frameworks and projects and approaches the schools can actually implement. And we're kind of in the quiet phase now of this work, but we expect that we'll be launching this network after the first of the year. And the momentum's pretty exciting. And so we're tremendously busy getting the stuff ready to go, but we think it will be beneficial to the world and impactful, and it will be fun.
Well, congratulations. Just based on what I've heard so far, your nonprofit organization is pursuing innovation better than some of the most highly capitalized corporations out in the marketplace.
Yeah, very much so.
Highly capitalized places like to assist us, we'd be happy to have them help us. So yeah, it's fun, right? And I think that's the thing, right? I think innovation, I'm not going to pretend that money doesn't help, but that is not at the core of what innovation is. It's not just about having more resources. And I think the more we can change people's mindset around this, starting with our kids, the better off we're all going to be.
So the second part of this two-part question was more about you as an individual. I love asking people for their prediction. Just plain old step up on the soapbox and tell me what you think is going to happen in the world on any subject. I mean, it could be the Patriots, whether or not they're going to win another Super Bowl. It could be the future of Singaporean politics, whatever. Give me a couple of predictions that we can hold. We can track and see if you are right.
Here's one prediction. I think that there's going to be a resurgence in the belief in the common good, and the government can play a part in that. And that's separate from politics.
In this, just to be clear, you mean in this country, right? Not some other
country. Yeah, I'm thinking, I can't really speak so much for, other countries because I'm not there as much. But what I'm seeing is...
Because it's deeply, deeply counterintuitive, what you just said. But okay.
I know it is.
But there was a statement by a bunch of CEOs within the last month or so about how the common good, they used other language, is the aim of a company, and not just shareholder value, which was quite controversial.
Yes, it was.
Yeah, it definitely wasn't. The phraseology was not common good.
But it wasn't just the old trope about
talking about basically impact, right? Like impact investing and all that stuff. Yeah. So part of that you have to take with a big fat grain of salt, right? But I see the analogy. I totally do.
Yeah, and I don't want to be like Pollyanna-ish, right? I mean, I'm not holding my breath on what these folks put out. I'm thinking more kind of fundamentally. I think people were in a period of time a few years ago that they were kind of thinking, it doesn't matter what I do. It doesn't matter my participation. It doesn't. And I think people are starting to see like, yeah, it kind of does. So we all play a part in this. I think it's going to look different than it may have back again in the 1950s or something. But I think there is becoming more of a sense of community matters. And I think that's pretty hopeful, actually, because we're confronting a future where the easy problems have been solved And so the ones that are left are pretty complex and people aren't going to really deal with them by themselves. And so I'm seeing more of a, how do we kind of join forces to address things? And so maybe I am Pollyannish, but I'm kind of seeing sprouts of this here and there. And I think it's heartening.
So I think it's time to start wrapping things up. I just want to say how much I've enjoyed this conversation. I would say that I'm a fairly cynical auditor of most of the information that I receive.
And I will back that up 1,000%.
I didn't know that. Okay. Well, I've been talking to a cynic. Okay. All right.
And I'm going to tell you point blank, this has been probably one of the two or three most enjoyable conversations that I've had since we started the Innovation Podcast back in late 2018, early 2019. I'm super grateful that you decided to come on, Moira, and share your views on the future of exploration learning and character building and the common good. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Moira.
You are so welcome. I really enjoyed it too. I'm glad we have this time together.
Thanks for joining Garnett and Mark on the Innovation Podcast. Visit theinnovationpodcast.co to subscribe and listen to other episodes.